This conference will now be recorded.
Good morning, 19th century Europe. Let's get going. My name is Tom Keefe, and I'm the babbling professor. Well, we left off with the end of Napoleon, right? He met his Waterloo, as they say. And so these counter-revolutionary forces, they all met in Vienna. They had a congress of sorts. They call it the Congress of Vienna. And they wanted to pretty much pretend nothing happened. Just mind your own business, go back to what you were doing. There was no Napoleon, there was no French Revolution, certainly no Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen, certainly no liberty, égalité, fraternité. No, we're just gonna turn it back. We're gonna turn back the clock. It's kind of like changing clocks at, you know, in the spring equinox and the fall equinox, right? It's like the same thing. We're just gonna pretend the last 15 to 25 years didn't happen. We're gonna redraw the maps. Ironically, one of the things that comes out of this this return to normalcy in Europe is the Portuguese royal family that had been hiding out in Brazil. Well, they come back because, you know, the continent's safe now, and they leave one of their kids, the fourth heir, back in Brazil to keep an eye on things. And that's how Brazil gets their independence. This fourth son, Pedro the First, overthrows his own dad, his own family, and declares Brazil an independent country. So that's one of the only, I guess, progressive, radical successes, accomplishments that occurs during this counter-revolutionary Congress of Vienna time. Like I said, they want to go back and pretend that none of the ideals of the French Revolution happened and that the borders get redrawn. In fact, they bring back their Bourbons to rule France as well. The guy who orchestrates this whole thing, this concert of Europe, is a young man named Prince Metternich of Austria. He actually lives a pretty long life, so his early images are paintings. And we do actually have a couple of photographs of him towards the end of his life. But Metternich orchestrated this Congress, and all of the winners of the Seventh Coalition, the people who defeated Napoleon, are invited. No radicals, no revolutionaries, no enlightened thinkers. These are power players, conservative status quo power players that meet together. Arthur Wellesley, the first Duke of Wellington. Like I said, Metternich himself is obviously there. You have a couple of other people that are famous in their own right, like Charles Maurice de Talleyrand, Francis II, the Holy Roman Emperor, who, remember, he, during the course of the Napoleonic era, had dissolved the Holy Roman Empire and changed the name of his country and his title to the Austrian Empire, Emperor of the Austrians, and at one point called himself King in Germany. So these are the people who get together and they basically make a deal that we're going to make sure nothing crazy happens again. They're primarily led by the four great powers of Austria, Prussia, Russia, and the UK. Later, they do let France in, so it becomes five countries that are kind of holding everything together, right? But of course, while they are working together to hold things down, they're also rivals against each other. But this is a significant step in the evolution of international law, probably the second most important step after Westphalia that we spoke about before in terms of the German religious wars and so forth. So this new international body, the Concert of Europe, that we call it the Congress system that they created, or some people call it the Vienna system. Their goals were to maintain their own power, oppose revolutionary movements, oppose nationalism, and maintain the balance of power. And they did that pretty much from the end of the Napoleonic Wars till the 1850s, like with the Crimean War. But there's always a but, right? There's got to be buts. Well, in France, let's look specifically at France. The Bourbons get invited back to take over. They actually write Napoleon out of history. The new king takes the title Louis the 18th, implying that there had been a 17th, even though he never reigned. The Bourbons come in and they don't learn. They just don't learn. Louis the 18th eventually dies at a ripe old age, but doesn't have any heirs. So his younger, quote unquote, younger, not really young, brother Charles takes the throne as Charles the 10th. And these guys they're counter-revolutionaries, they're reactionists, and they go too far. And so they're overthrown in the July 1830 revolution. In that revolution, the people of France demand a constitutional monarch. Well, the king, Charles the 10th, he abdicates, his heirs abdicate as well, and they go into exile in England. But one of their relatives, the cousin, Louis-Philippe, the Duke of Orléans, he promises he'll be a constitutional monarch and becomes the new king of France. But he too, you know, becomes a hardliner. And ultimately, these revolutions of 1848 spring up everywhere, but they start in France. And Louis-Philippe too is overthrown and goes into exile. In France, they originally call for an election. The revolution starts in, I think it's like February or so. By the time they get around to December, though, and they hold the elections, people had thought that the Republicans had gone too far and had become too radical. And so, ironically, they elect a conservative, this guy named Charles Louis, or just Louis Bonaparte. Louis Bonaparte becomes elected president, and he's not exactly a Republican, liberal radical idealist. He serves a term as president of the Second Republic of France, and then overthrows himself. But let's get back to why the people of Europe, particularly in France, but also later in Italy and Germany, Hungary, why they're rebelling. These are poor peasants or serfs in Eastern Europe, they might be called, and they're reacting to this conservative pendulum swing from the Congress of Vienna. The population's increasing. Most of these countries have lost some of their colonies. So there's, in the example of France, for example, they don't have the colony of New France, of Canada, to send surplus dissident populations. The populations are swelling and swelling. All across Europe, there's this movement towards enclosure. Hence, it's called the enclosure movement. So people are being kicked off of lands that they had been farming. The Industrial Revolution is starting particularly in England and in the United States, but slowly also developing in other parts of Europe. And so, again, people being drawn to the urban areas. There are food shortages, and you have a high population and a food shortage, no bueno. And all of these things are mixing and putting a lot of social and economic pressures on the political stability. And so the people that are coming in from the countryside and looking for work and looking for food, looking for jobs, working in some places in the Industrial Revolution, well, all of this explodes into unconnected revolutions of 1848. And in particular, besides the French Revolution, because we're going to be talking about these great powers that had created the Congress system, one of those great powers, if you remember, was Austria, the new Austria under Francis II. Well, Francis II ultimately dies. His heir, Ferdinand, is, well, I'll talk about him in a second, but the Hungarians revolt. The Hungarians had been like the 1A in the empire. There's one, which is the Austrian Germans, and 1A, the Hungarians. And then there's all of the other people, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Croats, the Romanians, Bosnians, Serbs, Transylvanians, Slovenians, Montenegrins, Kosovars, you name it, right? And all of these people are starting to, it's almost like a second French Revolution. The nationalism is starting to build, demands for respect, self-determination, linguistical rights, and stuff like that. And the leader of the Hungarians, Lajos Kossuth, he leads the Hungarian Revolution of 1848, which the Austrians cannot put down. They have to ask their Russians, their rivals, but also members of the Congress system to help them put down this this nationalistic liberal revolt. The Austrian Empire is just, it's so diverse, which I know we celebrate diversity today, but in Austria's case, the diversity was unwieldy because the minority populations were so repressed that as they start to speak out for themselves, the country became so unstable. It was really a slow death from I don't know, Francis II, all the way up to World War I, this inevitable rise of nationalism. As I said, Ferdinand I, the guy that was kind of left holding the bag there just before the revolutions started, he was the eldest son, therefore the heir of Francis II and Maria Theresa of Naples and Sicily. His parents, listen to this, his parents were double first cousins. Does that sound good genetically at all? Double first cousins? I'm not even sure I even understand what that means. He had epilepsy, hydrocephalus, neurological problems, and a speech impediment. It was actually written into his dad's will that while Francis was was going to be the emperor, that he wasn't allowed to make any decisions without his counselors. He was so incapacitated. So he abdicated in 1848 because of the pressures of the Hungarian Revolution. And meanwhile, back at the barnyard, back in France, I mentioned that Charles Louis Napoleon, had become elected president. He's the nephew of Napoleon I. He becomes, as I said, the president of the Second Republic and then overthrows himself and declares himself to be the emperor. But interestingly, he doesn't take the name Emperor Louis, as in like, you know, all the Bourbon kings, right? King Louis, 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 Louis. He takes his last name, or rather his uncle's first name, turns it into a last name, and then turns it into a first name again. He takes the name Napoleon III, recognizing his Napoleon II, who was his cousin, who was king of Rome, and was Napoleon's desire when he was defeated the first time. That he was succeeded by his son, Napoleon II, never happened, but still, just as the Bourbons pretended Louis XVII existed, Napoleon III pretends Napoleon II exists as well. Really, like I said, the central period of the 19th century belongs to Napoleon III. He successfully, you know, enemy of my enemy is my friend, he successfully pushes Austria out of northern Italy, in the process actually setting up the Kingdom of Sardinia, ultimately Piedmont Sardinia, to be the country that creates an entire united Italy, which hadn't happened since the Roman Empire. So Louis Bonaparte, you know, Napoleon III, he does get involved in this Austro-Sardinian War. He takes the field himself, but is smart enough to let the generals lead. There's the two significant battles. Funnily enough, one of them is called the Battle of Magenta. And during that battle, they discovered the dye magenta. And that's where we get the color from the town of Magenta, Italy. There's another important battle. What's it called? Like Safarino or something like that. But in those two battles in particular cement the Sardinian victory in pushing the Austrians out. So this is France exercising its strength again. He issues an announcement that, hey, I'm not going to take over all of Europe like my uncle did, but I'm also not going to let my neighbors get pushed around or my allies get pushed around. That country, his allies, the Kingdom of Sardinia, as I said, ultimately becomes the Kingdom of Piedmont Sardinia. Sardinia being an island, the third largest island, I believe, in the Mediterranean. Crete would be first, Sicily second, and then I think Sardinia third. But again, this non-contiguousness, right? That not only are they not touching, but there's the island of Corsica, which belongs to France, that's in between Sardinia and Piedmont. But eventually, as the House of Savoy solidifies its hold on northern Italy, this guy Garibaldi, who's a nationalist Republican, leads these wars against the Kingdom of Two Sicilies in the south, ultimately forcing the abdication of the king. And we're, even though he's a Republican, he's a nationalist, he wants a unified Italy, and he essentially delivers the Kingdom of Two Sicilies to the House of Savoy. They had been helping with naval support and blockades and such, but really Garibaldi takes over the south, House of Savoy takes over the north. They declare in what, 1860-ish or so, 1861, they declare the Kingdom of Italy, but they still don't understand how to get the middle part, which is owned by the Pope. The Pope is the both the temporal leader of the papal state, what we would call the Vatican today, as well as the spiritual leader. It takes them about 9 years to figure out the machinations of, I mean, if you're an Italian Catholic, how do you declare war on the Pope, right? But on September 10th, 1870, Italy does declare war on the Pope and annexes the papal states. So let's leave Italy for a bit. Let's go, meanwhile, in the halls of justice, let's go to Germany. Germany had been, you know, the many Germanys, not one Germany, right? The dominant German country was Austria, was the Holy Roman Emperor with his throne in Vienna, and now he's calling himself the Emperor of Austria, blah, blah, blah. Well, there's this startup country, right, in kind of northeastern, what we would call Germany today, and western Poland. And this country, of course, is Prussia. Well, Prussia grows and continues to grow south and southwest, driving into these small Germanies. Particularly, they wanted to eat up Brandenburg, right? Because Brandenburg, the Margrave of Brandenburg, was one of the electors, one of the four most important positions, the four political positions out of the seven electoral positions that ran the former Holy Roman Empire. So Prussia is now, they're like 1A. Austria's one, Prussia's 1A, and they want to figure out how to box out Austria. How can I get rid of Austria so that I'm the big fish? And so this is the debate, what we call Greater Germany or Lesser Germany, as Germany grows and drives and strives for unification. Greater Germany is the concept that Austria would be part of Germany, and Lesser Germany is the concept that Prussia would exclude Austria and then dominate the German states. That's what actually happened. After the Napoleonic Wars, Germany was reorganized into out of almost 300 states at one point, down to 39. And these states were enrolled in an Austrian-led confederation. But in the chaos of 1848 that we talked about in Hungary and we talked about in France, and I alluded to a little bit in Italy too. Well, the effect it has in Germany is that the Prussians gain control as Austria is weakened by all of these Hungarian and other nationalistic upstarts. So as Austria is distracted by their multi-ethnic, multi-religious state that's really, really more weighted down into the chaos of the Balkan Peninsula than in Germany, Prussia leaps into that power vacuum. Specifically, Frederick William III really starts putting moves onto the German states. Then there's the other Otto, right? Because the Otto was the first Holy Roman Emperor back centuries and centuries and centuries ago. Well, they bookend because there's this great Otto towards the end of the story as well. Otto von Bismarck, who was the Prussian chancellor. He was the right-hand man of the Kaiser. Ultimately, the Kaiser took the title of emperor as well, but Kaiser being the German word for Caesar, right? So trying to establish legitimacy and an aura of power. Yeah, they had a parliament, just like we talked about. You know, France has the Estates General that became the National Assembly, and obviously England has their parliament. The U.S. has Congress. The Russians have the Duma. Japanese have the Diet. You know, and in Germany it was called the Reichstag. But it was really just a rubber stamp. when the revolutionaries in 1848 tried to get Prussia to create a united Germany, they wanted to have a constitutional monarchy, and the Prussian autocratic absolute monarchs resisted that and then built an autocratic Germany later. The one of the most amazing handoffs in history, it's akin to the handoff in history from in 1588 between the Spanish and the British, and other places where we can see distinct handoffs of one major power to another. Well, the Germans, led by the Kaiser, but really being led by the will of the Chancellor, Otto von Bismarck. The guy's so cool that the United States has a capital, right? North Dakota is named after the Chancellor of another country that really had nothing to do with our country. Sure, there's German immigration, but that's what I'm saying. Like, that's the impression that this guy has made on history. And what he does is he makes an alliance called the Northern German Confederation. And he wraps in some of the German states, but he leaves out the southern German states that are kind of still in the sphere of influence of Austria. But he makes these defensive treaties. One of the treaties was like a one-year treaty that if there's a war with France, you got my back. And this is this, and then he starts poking the bear. Otto von Bismarck is poking the bear of Napoleon III. Napoleon III at this point has been ruling for 20 plus years. He's one of the longest rulers in French history. And so he eventually snaps. He's like, I got this. These German upstarts. They're being pushy. I got this. And he declares war on Prussia. That's exactly what Bismarck wants, because he wants to be able to play the card of the victim. He attacks France swiftly through the northeastern border. He gets the other Germans to support him. They actually, even more brilliantly, after they defeat several French armies, they even capture Napoleon III. They don't go after Paris. They circle around Paris and they wait for the Parisians to revolt themselves, which they do. The Paris Commune revolts and creates the Third French Republic, and then the two countries sue for peace, and really Prussia is now reforged as Germany, and they're reforged in the blood of the Franco-Prussian War. The proclamation of the German Empire proceeds. Germany is now a power player. They have legitimacy. They over the years, Bismarck continues his machinations. He calls the Congress of Berlin in 1878, where he essentially sets the rules and parameters for all of Europe for what becomes known as the scramble for Africa. You know, earlier in 1885, he held the Berlin Conference. I always get those confused, the Berlin Conference and the Congress of Berlin. In 1885, he matched out the rules for and the vision for European conquest of not just Africa, but the world, really. He is a legitimate power. He is pushing Germany into that what had been a small club of really of Anglo-Franco dominance. And for Americans, you know, a little trivia here, like the Treaty of Berlin, 1889, England, the United States, and Germany divide up the Samoan Islands. Essentially, England's paid off, they get something else. The Western Samoan Islands become German, the Eastern Samoan Islands become American. And that's how the United States got the southernmost territory of the United States, the Samoan Islands. And now here's where, you know, yes, Germany is rising, and it's at the expense of everybody around them. But England and France can kind of hold their own on the western side of Germany. But the Austrians, as I said, they're crumbling on the southern part of Germany, because they have, as I said, such a diverse ethnicity, and most of the people in the Austrian Empire don't speak German. They speak Slavic languages. And so this is the rise of the Russian bear. We said poke the bear earlier in France. Probably shouldn't have that, mixing my metaphors. But this is the rise of the Russian bear, sometimes cartooned as an octopus, the way it like weaves its fingers into things and then grabs on and tears them apart, whether that be Finland in the north, Poland in the west, or really, you know, well, actually, yeah, in the Caucasus regions in the southeast. But what for our story today, digging down into the Balkans, where they're interfering in the Austrian Empire because the Austrian Empire has this territorial integrity that should be respected by these rules, right? But the Russians see themselves as the leader of all Slavs. They espouse this pan-Slavic movement and identity, and they put themselves in the position of being the protector of the Slavic peoples in the Balkan Peninsula. But there's a third player. There's Turkey, the sick man of Europe, which is still in the southern part of the Balkans. So you have Austria in the northern part of the Balkans. You have Turkey, or rather the Ottoman Empire in the southern part of the Balkans. You have the tentacles of Russia digging in from the east or northeast into the Balkans. And again, Bismarck and Germany make themselves into a power player. They author a treaty to negotiate these boundaries, to give Romania more power, to give Serbian more autonomy, to give Greece some autonomy from the Ottoman Empire as well. And so this is it's a powder keg. This is like an old Acme Bugs Bunny commercial just waiting to explode. There's too much diversity, lack of political rights, a lack of political freedoms, and freedom of the press and freedom of speech. There's a lack of social mobility for non-Austrians and non-Hungarians, and all of these people are packed in this region of southeastern Europe, and it explodes in 1914. So that's just a little bit of one way to cover the 19th century. How do we get from 1814, 1815 with the end of Napoleon to 1914, really the beginning of the modern age, and signposted by World War I and the changes that makes in the maps of Europe and in international relations. So thanks for listening. My name's Tom Keefe, and I'm always your babbling professor.